Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. What happens when you give the homeless the means to express themselves?
When we share images with each other, it's so much easier for us to be able to immediately relate or engage with something visual.
Sarah Manriquez and the Through Our Eyes Project. Also, Hannah Hill from Stone Soup Cafe talks about the growing need to feed the hungry.
One of our casual sayings around here is that hunger is a need that's undiminished every day. You can't tell somebody who's hungry today that you fed them yesterday.
And UAF Poli-Sci Professor Alexander Hirsch and UA Press's Nate Bauer are back discussing the Petri dish approach to primaries.
Alaska won't be voting until April. By that time, not only will we have had these four primary contests in four individual states, we will have also had the benefit of hindsight looking back at Super Tuesday.
I hope you'll stick around. The Fairbanks Arts Association is accustomed to displaying images by local photographers. But the current display at the Traveling Bear Gallery is unique for several reasons. The photographers are homeless, and their work was nurtured by the passion of a University of Alaska Fairbanks student. I recently sat down with Sarah Manriquez to learn about the Through Our Eyes project and what drove her to help the marginalized find a means of expression.
A question that people have asked me is, why do this if I could just give money to the groups that you're trying to support? Because ultimately, a lot of the funds that come from this project, all of them go right back into the community who serve our homeless populations. So in this particular instance, Stone Soup Cafe, FNA Soup, The Door, those are all the people who worked with me on this project. And it's a good question. And I think where the intersection of art comes through is that art moves us. Art moves us and it matters. And it's one thing to just give money to things that are important to you, to organizations that you want to help. But this project is more than just about giving money to the organizations that serve our homeless populations. It's about advocacy. It's about literally seeing through their eyes. And it's very infrequent, it's rare that people who are disenfranchised, that people who, you know, are homeless, ever have the opportunity to speak on a platform. Normally, when there's a news story about homelessness in the community, wherever it may be throughout the nation, it's about those people, and those people are never interviewed necessarily. We don't say, hey, so what do you think? What do you want? What do you like? Why are you here? We just talk about them, those people, those anonymous people. And so this project highlights them as individual people, as individual artists with individual voices and stories that are important that we want to share with the community. And I think also homelessness is a really complicated issue. There's particularly right now a lot of different businesses and organizations who are starting to really get involved with trying to solve homelessness. And I think we're getting into a really interesting time in our society where we can really start talking about, but why are people homeless? Why does this happen? And be able to have that conversation. And with the Through Our Eyes project, it gives us an insight into their lives, a little tiny snippet, because what we ask them to do is document your lives. Do you have joy? What does that look like? Do you have challenge or struggle? What does that look like? Where do you live? What do you want to share with people? And so any image that they take is the right answer because it's who they are and it's their story that we want to share. And so I think the intersection of that art and journalism is so important and really at the heart of this project because it gives people the opportunity to stand on a platform and speak. It gives them an opportunity to share their story and to do it visually. And when we look at an image, when we share images with each other, it's so much easier for us to be able to immediately relate or think about or engage with something visual than it is just to say, can you give me $50 for the Stone Soup Cafe?
Mm. Were you always interested in art and why photography?
I've always been interested in art. I think that there is a lot of art blood in my family. My mom was an art major and a painter, And my grandmother was an off-Broadway actress in New York City. And she did quite a bit of theater and a lot of modeling. And when I was really, really little, about 3 years old, we lived in New Jersey. And she used to take me into the city in New York City and got me into modeling from a very young age. And then we decided to move to Honduras in Roatan. And it was due to my grandmother. She is definitely a bird of a different feather, but I have all of these really strong female role models in my life who are all deeply engaged in art in some way or another. And those have had a huge influence on me. And so because of that, I've always been interested in theater. I've been interested in modeling, and that's kind of progressed over time into combining a lot of other areas of interest. So as a high school student, I actually auditioned for Juilliard and for the Savannah College of Art and Design and wanted to pursue an art degree. And I had acted ever since I was about 7. And Juilliard audition is very intimidating. They actually had to fly out.
You think?
Yeah, I had to fly out from New Mexico, Albuquerque, New Mexico, to San Francisco to audition. And there were hundreds of people there. And only 8 of us were going to make it to the next round. And then out of all the people, they have a couple different sites around the country. Those people then go to New York City. And then I think only like 10 or 12 of them make it into the class. And I had no fear, actually, going into the audition. I felt really confident, and I had acted so many times and been to millions of auditions. And my Juilliard audition is the first audition where I walked in and just completely forgot my name, who I was, everything. I just completely botched it. So to say the least, I did not get into Juilliard. They kindly excused me for my audition after a few failed attempts. And so I ended up pursuing something much different. I pursued a different passion of language and culture, and I became a foreign language major at the University of New Mexico. And I was on track to be a foreign services officer with the Department of State, and University of New Mexico is a huge recruiting school for that. And I was in a really unique program that they no longer have, but when I was going there in 2009, they had this program. And it was a 5-language program. And the idea was that 3 of the languages, you would be proficient at the 200 level or above, and the other 2, you would be at the 300 level or above, and all target languages. So that way you'd be a more competitive applicant to be recruited for that foreign services officer position.
Wow. Well, what about photography? How did you get into photography with this background in theater arts?
Yes. So I can remember distinctly, ever since I was a little girl, thumbing through photos of my Nana, the one who modeled in New York City, and looking at those images and knowing that I had something really special in my hands, and also thumbing through family photos. I loved to be able to hold a moment that I could be immediately transported back into and feel like I was still living there. All the memories were fresh. The shirt was red. The smell of the cake was sweet. It was like the memories could just come rushing over me looking into a photo. And when we lived in Honduras, I used to run around everywhere with a disposable camera in my hand. Always. Everywhere I went, I had a disposable camera in my hand. And I'd climb through the mangrove trees on our property with this disposable camera, taking pictures of everything. And my Nana had this long-haired ragdoll cat named Sinbad, and I would brush him every day for 2 lempiras, and I would save up those lempiras to feed my camera addiction so I could buy another disposable camera and keep going. And so I have hundreds of photos as a kid with this disposable camera, and I've always loved this idea of being able to capture a moment, a fleeting singular moment that I wanted to remember in a distinct way. And so that disposable camera eventually turned into a small, compact digital camera, and then eventually turned into the DSLR that I have now.
Mm. Some photographers go in for landscape, and others do portraits in studios and try to get it very polished. What attracts you about these momentary images that grasp a dynamic situation?
So if you go to my website, you're going to see a huge array of work. And what I have a ton of work published on my website right now is actually the female nude figure. And that I photographed a lot when I very first started really getting into digital photography. And I think at first, when people look at my website, they think, what do any of these things have in common? I have, you know, the female nude, I have different travel images, and then I have a lot of this documentary photography predominantly around homelessness or poverty and things like that. And what I'm most interested in pursuing in all of the work that I do is understanding and exploring the human resilience. Resiliency is a topic, but the idea of the human spirit and what that means and what that looks like. And so with homelessness, I'm capturing and exploring this idea of human resiliency. And, you know, back to those female nudes as well, particularly I work with a lot of women who are maybe battling breast cancer or conquering a lot of insecurities around their bodies. And I'm really involved in the body positive movement. And so all of that comes back down to resiliency. What does that look like in human beings? And how do we try and capture that or explore that idea with photographs?
That's Sarah Manriquez, a photographer who organized the Through Our Eyes project that gave cameras to the homeless. Those images move next week to the Stone Soup Cafe. We'll continue our discussion following this break. You're listening to Northern Soundings, and I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Welcome back. I'm talking with Sarah Manriquez, a photographer who graduates this spring from UAF. Her passion for giving the marginalized a voice resulted in the Through Our Eyes project, currently on display at the Fairbanks Arts Association's Traveling Bear Gallery. Let's return to the conversation.
Well, I'm not surprised you learned about the Through Our Eyes project, but talk me through that connection.
So the very, very beginning of this project actually started out in the classroom here at UAF. I was taking a photojournalism seminar with the Snedden Chair at the time, who was Katie Orlinsky. And I was also taking a documentary film course with Rob Prince. And the classes really gelled together really nicely because even though they were in different mediums, one is being, you know, film, video, and the other being photography, we explored a lot of similar topics. And at the very beginning of the semester, one of the assignments we had in both classes was to find a social issue that we cared about and try to photograph it in a way we hadn't seen before. And immediately the first thing that came to mind was homelessness for me. And I wanted to photograph homelessness in a way that I had never seen it before. And so I went to the rescue mission, the Fairbanks Rescue Mission, and I wanted to specifically photograph an object in people's hands that they've hung on to, despite being homeless, despite losing maybe all or many of their worldly possessions. I've found that in our homeless communities, people usually keep one thing, usually. Something small, something that they can wear on their person, something that they can put in their pocket, but it's usually something that was given to them by someone who loved them very much. And it feels a lot like home. And so I wanted to photograph those things in their hands, and I wanted to learn what that thing was and what the story was behind it. And so that small project was called My Home in My Hands. And through that project, I made a lot of really special relationships, and one that I still have years and years later now. And I met a woman at the Fairbanks Rescue Mission. And she was a programmer there, so she was involved in their Genesis program. And her name is Felicia Kavanaugh. And Felicia was in a place in her journey where she was ready to share her story far beyond just an object that she had. For her, it was a photograph of her children. She has two kids. and her son and her baby daughter. And it's the only image that she has that both children are in the same photo. And it's her most prized possession. And Felicia and I became very close, and I started documenting her life. And through these, and with the guidance of Katie Orlinsky and Rob Prince, I was able to really make a lot of beautiful images of her life that really went deep, that explored what is it to be homeless? What are the obstacles? Because I was interested in breaking some of the stereotypes that often revolve around these issues. You know, people might say, why can't they just get a job? Why can't they just get a job? And then they're not going to be homeless. It's like, yeah, why can't they do that? But anyone who's involved in our homeless populations and work with these people know that that's not that easy. I mean, when you think about, even just as an example quickly here, if I go to an interview, what if I don't have an ID? How do I go to that interview to show them my license? It's something so simple. But when I fill out that application, where do I put my phone number? The shelter that I live at? What if I don't live at a shelter? What if I live on the street? How do you just apply for a job if you don't have a place to clean up, if you don't have the clothes to wear, or if you have no idea how you're supposed to play that interview game? And I think it's something that we take for granted so often. You know, you just show up this interview and it'll be fine and maybe you'll get the job. But for people who are experiencing homelessness, it's this whole other really challenging thing. The phone number, the ID, filling it out. Some people struggle with literacy. Other people are struggling with, you know, being clean, being able to have the proper clothes to go to an interview. So it makes it so much more complicated than that. And I, with Felicia, I, through her story, wanted to tackle a lot of those issues and say, okay, let's look at this stereotype. Why isn't or is it true? Let's look. And through her story, we were able to look at a bunch of different scenarios, a bunch of different stereotypes and obstacles, and really explore those things and talk more about why are people homeless and why is it so hard to get out of homelessness. And so I did that concurrently, both through photographs with Katie Orlinsky and in video with Rob Prince. And so as I kept going through this project, it evolved and evolved. I've been working with Felicia for years now. And I wanted to get to a point where we were going to show the work and exhibit the work and put it out to the public. And I had this small body of work that was called My Home in My Hands. So we had many different people's really intimate stories about things that really humanize them, things that are special to them. Everyone has something that's special to them, and that's easy to relate to. And I did them in black and white. I wanted to break down skin color, race, age, just focus on the thing in their hands and the story that it held. And then we had Felicia, who was, for me, really the face of homelessness. And she allowed me to, you know, look at her life and talk about her life and explore her life with her and look at those different challenges that she had to face. But I felt like there was something missing. There was something else missing. You know, Felicia's just one person. And although she's very, very dear to me, her story is unique to her. And so I started doing a lot of research about what else is out there. What are other people doing? Are other people exploring this? How are people who are homeless being photographed? What does that look like? And I found a lot of really disappointing results.
Disappointing how?
I found a lot of journalists who in the past have taken images of people who are unconscious on the street and used that as the headliner image in their news story about homelessness. And I thought to myself, what does this tell us about homelessness? Does this tell me anything about homelessness? Or does this really set the tone for the stereotypes that we have? Is everyone who's homeless drunken on the street? Absolutely not. But those are the images that we see. Are they the majority? Absolutely not. I would argue that the majority are predominantly in shelters or involved in some kind of program. And we don't see those people. They're almost even more invisible than the people on the street. And then I found some images that were really interesting to me. They were images of all of these different really special, intimate things about homelessness, like camps, like inside the camp, though. And they all had this film quality to them. And then I came across this video from these images that was called Through Our Eyes. oh, what is this? So I go to their website, check it out, and I found that, you know, all of these images were taken by people who are homeless, who have experienced homelessness. And it was like this light bulb went off in my head, and I was like, this is exactly what I'm missing from this work. This is exactly what's missing from this broader vision of what is homelessness, particularly here in Fairbanks and in the interior, is giving people the platform to tell their own story. And it's the photos that they capture are something that no journalist could ever capture for a couple reasons: permission and access. Those are hard things to get. And you may have access to something, but you may not have permission. But when you give the camera to the person who's experiencing these things, those barriers melt away because they have the permission, they have the access, because it's their life. And so they're able to really share some of these crucial, important insights into what it is to be homeless or houseless from their own perspective.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. I'm talking this segment with Sarah Manriquez, who organized the Through Our Eyes project. When we return from the break, we learn about the project's national roots. Listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks and Foundation Health Partners. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. I'm talking with Sarah Manriquez, who organized the project that gives homeless residents cameras and then displays their work. Let's return to our conversation.
How do you go about selecting who will participate in the program, and then how do you get cameras in their hands?
Good question. So Jason Williamson is the creator of the Through Our Eyes project, and he's located in South Carolina. So those were my questions as well when I very first came across the project. I thought, how do I get this to Fairbanks, and what are the logistics of that? What's the cost of that? What does that look like? So I reached out to him on his website and introduced myself and told him I wanted to bring it up to Fairbanks, and I immediately got a response. And he was like, great, let's do it. And he has this whole packet put together that makes it pretty easy for anyone to be able to try and lead or run this project. And so it kind of has some step-by-steps. Some things I already knew, like it's geared towards someone who's maybe never put a show on in a gallery, because ultimately we want these images to be shown in the public. But other things were so crucial to be able, for me to be able to plan properly and get this thing up and running. And so he was able to send me 100 cameras completely free, donated through Fujifilm to the project. And there are a lot of other donated items that he was able to send me in order to make this project happen. And so that was immensely helpful. So I just had this big box arrive in the mail that was filled with 100 cameras. It had some T-shirts in it that had like the Through Our Eyes project on it. It had one of the books that they had produced from a bunch of the projects that they have done to give me an idea of what people have done in the past, so I could also share them with our photographers and say, hey, look, this is what other people did. Because sometimes it can be pretty daunting to just be handed a camera and be like, tell me your life. So then what Jason does, he's a pastor. And so a big part of his message when he goes out into the community is to invite people to his place of worship and say, you're welcome here. And I think that message is really important, because so often we have signs up, you know, don't come in here. If you don't have money, if you can't pay, stay out. And his message is, no, but you're welcome here. You're welcome here. You're loved here. You're valued here. And so what he was really hoping for me to be able to do was pair the project up with the Faith Home, so that way that similar message could be given out. I wasn't really able to do that here in Fairbanks. And so instead, I kind of went right to the heart of where many of people in Fairbanks go who are experiencing homelessness, and that was Stone Soup Cafe. And I reached out to Hannah and asked her if she could be the home of this project, if Stone Soup could be the home of this project. And she's just been amazing to work with, so, so, so great. And so we did our camera distribution at Stone Soup Cafe back in August. And about 10 volunteers helped me, and each volunteer had a singular task. So there's a form that we have to have participants fill out who would like to participate. And there really isn't a selection process. It's basically just anyone who wants to participate can. So if they're interested, come on over. We got a camera for you.
Interesting.
And so we have to get a little bit of their information, like their name. A lot of it is like the information that we would get. We're pretending that every single person is going to make it into the show. And so we want to get all of that information up front, because oftentimes it can be really difficult to track people down. So we want to know what their name is, what their contact information is, if they have a phone. If they don't, where can we find them? It's one of the questions that we have on the actual form. Where can I find you? So that way we can try and track them down. And because we also give them a copy of every single photo that they took. And if they have an email address or any way to receive it electronically, they get digital copies of every image that they take too. And then I was taking portraits of people who are interested. And then I was also printing their portraits and giving those to them as well. And so the volunteers help them fill out this form, just kind of step by step. And then we also get their signature, because I put all their signatures together on a single document and made a stamp, because I'm hoping to, over time, build a really big body of this work and put it together in a book. And for any of them who can't be there to sign that book, I want to make sure that on that stamp, every single one of them can sign that book and be a part of that final product.
How many cameras did you eventually distribute, and how many did you get back?
So between Stone Soup Cafe, The Door, and FNA Soup, we distributed 37 cameras. And typically the project usually expects less than 50% of them to come back. It can be really, really difficult to track your belongings when you're homeless, particularly if you're on the street. And most of the photographers that we were working with in this particular case were on the street. And so we received about 23% of cameras back. But the most important part, I think, is that they enjoy the experience. Because a big part of this, of course, we want the images and we want to share those. But this project is centric around their experience. What did they think?
And they only have it for a week, right?
Yes.
And so tell me, what did they think?
In this particular instance, when I was handing them out in August at Stone Soup, it was right when it was turning fall. And so they captured a lot of fall colors in a lot of these different images, or we got to see the season kind of change within a week. And because of that, a lot of them actually asked me if they could keep the cameras a little bit longer. So some of our photographers had them for about a month. And I would keep returning back to Stone Soup Cafe to check in and collect anything if they had them, and also distribute photographs and portraits and stuff like that as I was getting them. And when they get a camera, we give them a couple other things too. We give them a care package that has, you know, like granola bars and water bottle and different other things that they might need that might just help them a little bit. But they also get a t-shirt that says photographer, and they get a little bit of training if they'd like it on, you know, how do you capture a good image? What does that mean? What does that look like? So I had a few of my local photographer friends who were there as well, kind of going over that and showing them some of the images that had been captured before. And the reactions that we often had were big smiles, big, big, big smiles. And I think part of it comes from the fact that it's not often that they get approached and people say, I really want to hear from you. I really want to hear your story.
I'll bet. The relationship is completely different.
Yes.
Suddenly they're an artist, a photographer, instead of being a homeless person.
Exactly. And I think that that transition is really important, because we emphasize that to them a lot. We never call them like our homeless people or something like that. They're always our photographers. They're our photographers, our artists. And on the back of a t-shirt that they receive, it's photographer. That's their title. They are photographers. And some different things that people have said to us, but that Jason's heard as well, the creator of the project, is they've told us, you know, I got to be a photographer for a week. Not a homeless person, not someone on the street, not someone who is begging, not, you know, someone who's experiencing, you know, maybe something challenging or difficult, but I got to be a photographer. And being able to kind of change that, even if it's for a week, even if it's for a month, was made a big difference for the people who wanted to participate. It's exciting. They get to be something other than. And I think that's exciting for anyone when you get to kind of step out of what you're normally doing and do something a little bit different. And so when I checked back in with a lot of our photographers here in Fairbanks, a lot of them didn't have their cameras. I mean, we had about only 20% of people, maybe 23% of people return them. But I said, well, did you have a good time? Always a big smile. They said, yeah, I had so much fun. And a couple of them told me that it was really fun to be able to look at their lives, their experience, where they lived, and think about it a little differently. How do I want to show this to someone else? And that was really neat.
So the exhibit is at the Fairbanks Arts Association spot on the corner of Lathrop and Van Horn. When that display ends at the end of the month, where will it live after that?
It's going to go to Stone Soup. I'm really excited. Hannah and I have been talking quite a bit, and it's really important that the photographers get to spend some time with their work on the walls. A lot of our photographers weren't able to make it for the gallery for various reasons. It's a little far from the bus line. They were a little kind of unsure where it is. I think some of them might have been a little intimidated to go into a new space that they hadn't been in before. So only a couple of our photographers have seen it in the gallery space outside of images of it. And so we really want to make sure that they get to spend some time with that artwork on the walls in a place that they frequent. And it seemed perfect to have it in the place that the project started here in Fairbanks, which is Stone Soup Cafe.
Well, Sarah, what's ahead for you? You graduate in May, is that right?
I do.
Woo, mazel tov. That's wonderful. But so what's ahead for you?
So I'm going to be staying in Alaska for, I think, quite a few years to come, as far as I can see. But one of the things that I'd like to continue to do with this project and continue to do with this work is I'm trying to figure out how to make the project sustainable in a way that I can keep it going. And so the project kind of has these three parts. It has the Through Our Eyes portion, My Home in My Hands, and Genesis, which is the work about Felicia specifically. And in my fantasy world of goals and where I'd like to head is every year I'd like to work with a single community different from Fairbanks, somewhere new in Alaska. And I'd like to focus all my energies and efforts with that particular community and bring the Through Our Eyes project to that community and find a member of their community who's like a Felicia, who's ready to share their story and is in a place where they want to champion their cause and talk about some of the struggles that they've faced. And then also build a body of work for My Home in My Hands with those community members. So then at the end of the year, that new community has a special body of work that reflects all of the people who they know, who they live with, who they see every day. And every year, I'd like to take it to a new community and do that for quite a few years until it's a much bigger body of work. Because I think the challenge with Alaska, whether you're visiting here or trying to figure out where to live here, or however you're looking at Alaska, it's a big state. And I think the reality is, you know, if you live in the interior in Fairbanks or if you live in Anchorage, that's very different. If you live in Nome, if you live in Kaktovik, that's very different. But the reality is homelessness is in all of those places. And it looks very different in each of those places. There are going to be some core things that I think will be similar across the board. But I don't think it would do it justice to end here in Fairbanks and say, okay, that's it, guys. That is what homelessness looks like in Alaska. Because it's not. It's only the very, very tip of the iceberg. It's this small little intersection of Fairbanks. But there's so much more. And I think with a bigger, broader body of work, it's going to tell us and show us a lot of things as a state than it will just with one community.
Well, Sarah Manriquez, we'll look for these projects down the line.
Thank you.
Links to Sarah's work and the Through Our Eyes project are on the Northern Soundings website. As I mentioned, part of the display currently hanging in the Fairbanks Arts Association's Traveling Bear Gallery moves next week to Stone Soup Cafe. When we return from the break, I'll talk to Stone Soup's executive director, Hannah Hill, about how art fits with feeding those in need. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings, and as you heard earlier in the program, Stone Soup Cafe is one of the partners of the Through Our Eyes project. I talked with the cafe's executive director, Hannah Hill, about it and how the state of feeding the needy is going.
We call ourselves an anti-hunger organization because there's a lot of different ways that hunger can impact people, and it's how we directly interface with poverty is from a food perspective. There's many ways that poverty impacts people's lives, but hunger is the way that we can deal with it. One of our casual sayings around here is that hunger is a need that's undiminished every day. You can't tell somebody who's hungry today that you fed them yesterday. So our principle here is that we're a no-barrier soup kitchen, at least in that aspect of it. So we don't have sobriety requirements. Our few rules are kindness to yourself and others, no disruptive behavior. Because we want people to be able to come in and eat food in a safe space no matter what. So being anti-hunger means also that we have a community garden that we grow food out of to show folks how to do urban gardening, if at all possible, and lower barriers for folks that maybe rent, don't have a place to do it, don't have time to do it, don't know how to do it. We're able to work, we're big believers in community collaboration. Same with our culinary job training program. That's another way to tackle poverty and hunger, is teach folks how to cook professionally, but also for themselves. Talk about nutrition, talk about how food comes to places. In all this, we also have a kids' cafe, which is where we talk about food insecurity a lot and what food insecurity means in our community. A lot of people just think, you know, food insecurity, don't have enough food to eat. But a lot of times, especially in Alaska, it's maybe perhaps the type of food that you have. If you lived rurally and then you come into the urban centers of Anchorage or Fairbanks, you may no longer have access to food that is very important to one culturally and also psychically, like, you know, in your mind and in your general spiritual well-being. That's a type of food insecurity. And we try and address all of these as much and as best as we can through the help of our community.
Now, I'm always impressed by just the high quality of the food. Mm. Where does the technique and the skill come from? And where does the food come from?
Well, the skill comes from Chef Matt, who is our morning time chef here, and he's a high-powered guy. Like, he has worked in major kitchens all across America, and he's one of the people that helped start Lavelle's as, like, a kitchen. He was the one that got hired to bring in and start this. He really knows what he's doing when it comes to food as a concept. The food that we get here is mostly from donation. We're fortunate to have to buy very, very little because of our community partnerships and people that also see the value in food reclamation is a lot of what we do. Several times a week, the Fairbanks Food Bank gives us what we need to make our food happen. We're able to send over a little shopping list, and one of our volunteers goes and picks up everything that is available. It's not, you don't always know what you're going to get, but we get what we can to try and serve nutritious food every day. And then we do food reclamation with Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, so we're able to go and get some of their leftovers and then incorporate that into our meals as well. Also, a lot of local folks just bring by food as much as they can. Sometimes it's just a few bags of spices when someone's moving. Sometimes they're cleaning out a freezer. A lot of times, now that Costco is open in town, people will buy bulk items and will bring us what they don't need, their surplus, which is generous, and we're grateful for that. So sort of a combo of Matt's technical know-how as well as the high-quality food that is given to us by our community.
Mm. How many people do you customarily serve? I was interested to learn that even in the cold of winter, you may not see your highest number of patrons. Mm-hmm.
I know it's surprising, right? When folks, before they come here, they're like, oh yeah, wintertime, it's cold and it's hard and dark and gross, so we're going to come. But like, that's not, we're much busier in the summertime. And that comes down to logistical issues. It's cold. Are you going to get out of where you are warm and safe and then probably walk here? Are you going to catch a bus? Is it a holiday? Are there buses running? Is the bus going to take you somewhere that you can go afterwards? Like, all of these things, like, do you have money for a bus to even begin with? So when it gets cold, people, A, tend to kind of hunker down, those that are here. But in the wintertime, folks being transitory do try and leave. Fairbanks is not a friendly place to be experiencing deep poverty. So in the wintertime, folks do try and get out of the town. And then you come back in summer when there's jobs, when there's day labor, these things that are more helpful for one's well-being. So yeah, summertime is busier than wintertime. We average out right now in the wintertime to about 100 people a day that we serve, give or take. We don't really get to know why that is a lot of times. But summer is substantially more busy, and we've been progressively more busy since we started tracking this in 2014. We've been substantially more busy every year. And some people are like, good job. And we're like, no, that's not a positive thing. That means that there's more need in our community. We're also seeing more new people, more new faces, more frequently, which is alarming. So last year, I said we do about 100 people a day. Last year, we served over 31,000 hot meals.
It looks like breakfast is that main meal of the day. How did you guys hit on breakfast to focus on?
There's a number of other places that people have access to emergency food services like ours in town, and breakfast was just sort of the one that is by the wayside.
Kind of like the whole
thing. We're fortunate because there's, on the weekends, several of the local religious organizations host food, so we're able to just be Monday through Friday so we can actually give our staff a day off. I mean, the need is large, and I do not want to diminish that, but because our community cares, people are serving at different levels. So Breadline started in 1984 with just some folks handing out sandwiches from backpacks in downtown Fairbanks, and has grown to this largely by asking folks what they need, like how can we help, and this is where we're at right now.
Do you rely on grants and donations to make ends meet?
We have a couple different ways that we find our funding here. We believe in having earned income as much as possible, because if there's one rule about grants, it's that grants go away. And we don't ever want to have to limit our service based around the whims of funders. So we bolster our programs through grants, but a lot of the money that we have comes from individual donations. First off, the people of Fairbanks donate to us. Folks that don't need our services are supporting people that do, and that's just enormous. We recently launched this conceptual plan called the 6% Club, which I did some math, and of the Fairbanks, like, city proper, if 6% of the adult population gave us $10 a month, we would never fundraise again.
That's which a is, staggering statistic.
I know, it's right, but it's still about 8,000 people. Like, that's a fair deal of people, but that's, like, an achievable number that when I started thinking about it like this, and I was like, that's not much. You know, but again, it's talking to people. What are we advertising for our services? Like, that's not, so if folks have not needed our services, they may not know about us, or if they haven't gotten through the word of mouth of volunteering with us, which is how a lot of folks find out, oh, somebody's been quietly volunteering for years here, and then they tell their friend, and their friend's like, can I come and volunteer? Next thing you know, we always say, when we get you through the door, you're ours, because folks see what we do here, they see the importance of it, and want to support that. So earned income, a bulk of it is community donations from individuals who give to us, some grant work, and we also work with Rasmussen Foundation and Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and also in community partnership with Tanana Chiefs, and it takes all of us to make this possible at all.
No, I'm sure. You said the need for stone soup is growing. Any ideas about why that is?
One of the challenges of this is that we don't get to know exactly a lot. The folks that we serve are very private a lot of the time, so some folks will tell you. My personal opinion, and all it is a personal opinion, is that we're sort of a canary in a coal mine when it comes to economics in our state. And what I hear is a lot of folks that used to have jobs don't have jobs anymore. Like, folks that were working and working professionally, like in skills-based careers, and those jobs aren't there for them. Maybe they're a little older. They're not able to find the support that they found otherwise. Can't get the jobs they used to get, and then there's not a lot for them to fall back on, especially with the way that the state budget cuts have gone. We also have people that are living in more of a state of fear about being secure, and a lot of times it is our elders or it's folks that are living with disabilities that are suddenly unsure of what's coming next. So people reach out and access resources as they need to. We're grateful that they can come to us and feel like that's a place for them to achieve at least a warm meal, a hot meal in a safe space.
Now, the Through Our Eyes project, obviously meant to address maybe a similar population or need. How did you learn about it, and how did you think that would be a great partnership?
Yeah, well, Sarah Manrique has reached out to us personally. And I'll tell you, it's funny. Initially, I was a little trepidatious about it because a lot of times people want to talk for other people, which is not our vibe here. Like, folks get to tell their own story. So I was a little uncertain initially when she first, like, just sent me an email. But then she came here and I was like, I'll get back to her. And then she came down here and once we sat down and talked about it, and she's like, no, we're going to give folks cameras so they can tell their own story. And then we're going to blow up these photos enormous and show it to people at the Bear Gallery. And I'm like, oh, no, that's great. Let's do that immediately. Like right now, it's great. And I also really appreciated the way that she was really, it's like, you know, it's called Through Our Eyes, but her eyes were wide open in it. That, again, we have a population of folks that are living in extreme crisis all the time. I was like, you may not get your cameras back. Like, folks just aren't living in a way that they can be that orderly about things. And it's not like they're stealing a camera, right? It's just that you're going to tell them to come back in a Tuesday a month from now? Like, that's a lot to ask. And she was like, no, I know. And she's like, if we get one camera back, great. If we get no cameras back, that's also okay. Because we're just trying to give people an opportunity to tell a little bit about themselves. And once I saw folks reacting to this opportunity, being given a camera, being given a shirt and a cute little like care bag, they were so jazzed about it. And she had to sit down with them and talk to them too, because they want to take like one photo today and then one photo in 6 months, like be so careful with it. And she was like, no, take all the photos, like just run through it, as many photos as you want to do. I, in going and seeing the exhibit too, that was just exceptional, because again, I was still, I was like, I knew, I trust her, but at the same time, I get so nervous about the way that people can be presented, because there's so much of this us versus them type thing that is profoundly negative and hurtful to people. And when I went there and it was just people's stories being told themselves in a whole and truthful way and seeing their really unique lens into a life that people aren't experiencing and don't know about. So this is a great way to like look at somebody and be like, hey, human, here's another human that's experiencing some hardships that if you think about a little bit, there's a way to help.
And I think that's really a connection that I see, is that you treat all the people who come through these doors with dignity and respect, and you know them by first name basis.
We're all just people out here living on this spinning rock. If we don't treat each other with kindness and compassion, what are we doing? Making someone's day empirically worse when you don't need to do that. And yeah, these folks are just folks. I'm just folks. We've all at some point needed a helping hand, and at the other time, there's always a way to help somebody else no matter where and who you are. And so to be able, with Through Our Eyes, when they also brought up the fellow that actually started the thing. He came here and worked for a while. And that felt really good, just to be able to make this connection, saying like nationally, there's a way to shift the way that some people are being able to look at other folks and being able to see the way that they're living through their eyes and recognize that it's not that different. Like, people frequently think that folks that are experiencing extreme poverty are like different somehow. And it's like, nope, we're all just humans. And we're all very close to living this exact same way. So let's make it better. Just, we don't have to live this way.
Well, the big challenge will be now, where are you going to put the photographs on your wall? Because it looks like you don't have a lot of wall space here.
No, we always joke that we need a bigger boat, because this place is, we're just to the gills. We're just going to make do. We have these nice closets, so we're going to hang them up on the closet walls. We'll probably pull down a couple of the artwork that we have up currently, and we're going to make space for it, because we're bringing this show here. We're like, if we can't bring the soup kitchen to the show, we're going to bring the show to the soup kitchen, which I'm very excited about. That's going up in March. So it's great to be able to work with Sarah on that and like hang a show here. And that was part of it, was we had plans when originally, because we've been talking about this for ages, right? It was going to be at the Bear Gallery at Pioneer Park. And when that was no longer a space that was available, the new Wandering Bear Gallery, which I love, is not at a place where we can help our folks get to. Previously, we're like, give them a fistful of bus tokens. You'll go see your show if you want to go see your show. But now it's in a place that's not really possible to do. And we were like, what are we going to do? So Sarah was like, let's bring it to the soup kitchen. The best idea I've ever heard. I'm really excited for it.
Well, Hannah Hill, thank you so much for talking with me.
It's my pleasure, Robert. Thanks for making time.
Links to Stone Soup Cafe are on the Northern Soundings website. Following this break, the grand experiment of American politics. Welcome back to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. Throughout this election cycle, UAF political science professor Alexander Hirsch and University of Alaska Press director Nate Bauer are stopping by to give an Alaskan perspective on the political process. I spoke with them before the Nevada caucus, but I wanted their take on whether primaries and caucuses were relevant. Nate responded first.
I think it's relevant in terms of each state. You know, as a country, we're an amalgam of states and processes and eccentricities. And I think each state should consider themselves a laboratory for trying out some different things, maybe especially states that don't have a tremendous impact percentage-wise on, you know, the number of delegates they award. I think that we have local and regional and state politics. We have a role in the nomination process for the candidate for the general election for president. And if we're going to consider those things, our processes and the machinery open to change and to adjustment, I think that that's sort of where it happens. That's sort of where we try these other things out. I think it's relevant, especially this year, because Alaska is trying out some different things when it comes to the primary here.
Right. We don't have a caucus in the Democratic Party anymore. The Republican Party in the state has decided not to have a primary at all, for instance. So there are some changes in the state, and there's that. But I think having a little bit of time, Alaska won't be voting until April. And so by that time, not only will we have had these four primary contests in four individual states, we will have also had the benefit of hindsight, looking back at Super Tuesday a month earlier. You know, it's interesting. In New Hampshire, a lot of voters who voted in the Democratic primary, who came from highly educated backgrounds, who were interviewed as they were exiting polling stations, talked about voting for Amy Klobuchar as opposed to Elizabeth Warren, so swinging from a nominally progressive candidate to a more moderate one. And they said the primary reason for doing that was that they were impressed by Amy Klobuchar's performance in the Democratic debate the night before, which I find really interesting because there's active discussion and controversy over whether or not the Democratic debates or the Republican debates, when there's an active Republican primary, have much of an influence over primary outcomes. And here you're seeing these results out of exit polling from people saying, yeah, we're listening to the candidates, we're thinking about what they're saying, and we're comparing and contrasting what they're saying with what we want. I think this year in particular, what I'm hearing from Democrats in Iowa and New Hampshire and beyond is that it's not only that primary voters are interested in voting for a candidate whose identity and whose interests and whose politics match their own, but primarily they're looking for someone who can compete with the president in the general election. And so there's a lot of projection work there. There's a lot of guesswork. There's a lot of wondering about who other people might be willing to vote for in a general election. Being here in Alaska, we don't vote until April, and that's unfortunate because we don't get to jump in early to try to shape public perception. But at the same time, voting a little bit later means we do get the benefit of getting to assess where other states are coming from and have that time for reflection. It's sort of structurally built into our process. So.
Nate, you talked about an opportunity as a laboratory to try out new things. Do you think Iowa's debacle with its app kind of caused some states, Nevada comes to mind, pull back from any innovations? Let's go back to stone tablets or abacuses, right?
Yes, I think that that has definitely happened. I think there's been news stories about Nevada changing their minds about the way that they want to, kind of at the last minute, which I don't know. I will be curious to, I guess it will have been yesterday that the Nevada results will have come in at the time this airs. Yeah, well, of course, when you're conducting experiments and when you're considering yourself a laboratory, you should be focused on the results and focused on learning what prior results can teach you. So I think that's appropriate. I think that that fits in definitely with the idea that states do these things differently. The state parties make decisions on their own about how their processes happen and who gets the delegates. I think that sometimes that can feel pretty convoluted and obtuse. That's another thing that I guess I have come away, a takeaway for me from both Iowa and New Hampshire, is that the closer you look at how those delegates are awarded and the process of who's viable at which point, it sure seems like there's still, I know we talked about institutional control a little bit last time. It still seems like there's a lot of institutional control, at least at the state level. And I wonder not only how that's going to play out in each individual state, but then also once the convention gets closer, what people's thoughts and forecasts are for what actually happens at the convention. Because it seems at least possible that we're going to get to the convention without a candidate having a majority of the delegates. And it gets kind of tricky at that point.
Yeah, I think that's right. Americans, we like to think that we live in a democratic society. Mm. And in many ways, we do have institutions that bear democratic resonance. We have political institutions that aspire to the ancient Athenian ideal of citizen participation. And in many ways, we reflect more democratic privileges as a citizenry than a lot of other countries in the world. But at the same time, it's important to notice that the framers of our Constitution deliberately created a check on absolute democracy, rule of the people, was not their ambition. It was not the political goal. The general perspective of the people having an advisory role on the shape of government and policy was important. But equally important to the framers was establishing a set of barricades that would prevent democratic energies, democratic passions.
Mob rule.
Mob rule, exactly, from becoming overly influential in the way that we establish laws and deliberate over moral questions and political questions.
I have a question for you, Alex.
Oh.
This is a good segue. I would like to take the opportunity, Robert, if it's okay, to plug the book club that we've been operating. The University of Alaska Press has been doing a book club, and I plug it to listeners. And if you're free on Monday evenings at 7 p.m., we meet here at the pub on campus. And we're reading a book called These Truths, and it's by Jill Lepore, and she covers a lot of these issues that Alex is talking about. There's a passage from the book, and I was actually looking forward to getting Alex's take on it. She says, when she's writing about the Constitution, there are ideas that come from Aristotle about the three forms of government, and that those three forms are an aristocracy, a monarchy, and a polity, and that each one of those can be corrupted. A monarchy that's corrupted becomes a tyranny, an aristocracy becomes an oligarchy, and a polity becomes a democracy. The point there, I think, is that even at that period in time in what were to become the United States, there was negative connotation around the idea of democracy. And I think that what we're talking about when we talk about the control that state democratic parties and the National Democratic Party has in this primary process that we're discussing may be that process of trying to prevent a polity from becoming what the framers would have referred to as a democracy.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of, you know, what Winston Churchill said, that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the other forms.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of how the framers felt as well. And they were influenced by Aristotle, and I love hearing about monarchy, aristocracy, polity, and the potential corruptibility of those political forms in Aristotle. It comes from an early passage, by the way, in The Politics, to plug another book, and that could be a chapter
we'll
for another
pick it up
book.
Next time.
Right. Yeah, I think that idea is precisely what the framers had in mind when they were trying to establish essentially a government that was sort of an ecology of checks and balances. Monarchy, aristocracy, polity, you could think about that as executive, legislative, judiciary maybe isn't the polity, but you have the popular vote there. And I think that the framers were also influenced by Native American ideas, actually, when they were thinking about the appropriate political form that the United States ought to take. They were influenced by the Iroquois idea of federalism, this kind of nested sovereignty idea. Came from, it's a traditional Haudenosaunee form of thinking about political affiliation and political identity. And actually, the word caucus, which we've been using, is an Iroquois term. Mm. And so you see that, you know, interesting way in which, you know, the framers, they were very much interested in imposing checks against popular will and popular sovereignty and populism. And they did it both by reading Aristotle and by looking around at the practical ways in which people who lived in America before America was settled and founded.
And I just want to point out, especially in light of the new official architectural style, both Nate and Alex are wearing togas for this recording.
Links to Alexander Hirsch and UA Press's book club are on the Northern Soundings website. That's it for the show. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. We'll see you next time for Northern Soundings Alaska in Conversation. Thanks for listening.